Good day and welcome to the podcast, To Be More. I'm your host, TJ Smith. To be more is exactly what we want. We want to be more than some of the problems that we all know exist in our metro area. Have you ever wondered about a new building and the process that it takes to get built or approved? Or why it takes so long to get something built in the area? Have you seen the signs or heard the announcements about a project? But it could be years before there's any activity. What is the process? Are there any ways that we can be more creative? What about projects that are started and they stall? Why does that happen? Let's try to understand a little bit more of these processes and more on Baltimore's buildings and how we can build equitably around Baltimore. Joining me now is Justin Williams, who is a partner in the Land Use and Zoning Group at Rosenberg Martin Greenberg LLP, where he advises on land use, zoning, permitting, and liquor licensing matters for developers, landlords, and bar restaurant operators in the greater Baltimore region. Thank you very much for joining me, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. So let's jump right into this. And I'm going to read a headline from a 2016 WMAR story. Murder Mall cleared for New Madison Park North. And then the subheadline was Baltimore leaders have pledged to tear down 4,000 vacant properties in 4 years, but few will be as symbolic as one known as Murder Mall. Now, this project in 2016 was announced. I happened to be there because I was working for the city at the time. And the mayor was there. The governor was there. They actually had the schematics for the apartments and the retail and the grocery store. They were tearing down this project. This is right at the area of like Mount Royal and North Avenue in that general area. And this is 2016. This is 6 years ago. It's a pile of rubble today. How do projects like that take so long and get stalled?
Yeah, so I don't have a specific, I guess, insight into the project or I'm not involved with the project, but I think it's in a symbolic picture of like how long the development process can take, even with the best intentions, with political support. People kind of always think there's corruption or an issue with the developer basically lying to the public, but often people forget how long it can take to organize financing, go through the approvals process, and deal with the ongoing issues that might arise during a development project. And so here, like I said, I'm not sure exactly what happened or why there's been a delay here, but often with, especially projects with affordable housing components, there's issues with timing and making sure the development project pencils out. And if things change with the pro forma and the level of rent that can be paid by tenants or residents, that might force the developer to go back to the drawing board. I've been in a number of projects where this even before the most recent rise in like inflation and supply costs, but the client had to go back to the drawing board and value engineer a project because they learned the cost would be too high to use steel for a larger development. What's the height that a project could be, for example?
So in a project like the Madison Park, for instance, and I know that there have been some updates, and late 2021, they were given some green lights and the project has changed a bunch from its original form. But let's just say, we know the economy's changed a great deal from 2016, no coronavirus and no war in Russia and Ukraine. But let's say it falls through. Is that possible, you know, that it could fall through completely and the residents of that area are left with a pile of rubble? And I'm not saying that that's happening because that's no indication that that's happening. But does that possibility exist that that deal could fall through and it could be just a pile of rubble?
It does. And it could be no fault of the developer. It could be. I mean, I don't want to foreclose that possibility, but one of my overarching views or critiques of the city's development process, and this is coming from someone who used to work in the city government about 10 years ago, is the city ideally could focus on things in its control and do what it can to help the process. There's like a saying that time kills all deals. And so the longer the time goes on to get approvals, there's a greater risk of things changing, whether it's supply cost or construction costs going up, to the market demand changing from maybe a mixed use office site that might have been proposed here. I'm not sure, but if office is no longer going to be a viable use here, then they'll have to go back to drawing board again and change the plan around. Changing plans around through the city, depending on how a level of like review you've had, might require going back to the site plan review committee, the urban design and architectural advisory panel, which requires bringing in consultants again and paying for lawyers and architects and engineers to come back multiple times to redesign a site. So the longer the city draws up the process, the longer it can take. There's obviously benefits to having more review and getting more community engagement, but the downside is it costs more and creates more risk for the developer.
Right. So are there any, so for like a transitional neighborhood, I mean, this place was dubbed Murder Mall. It was an apartment complex that human beings lived in Baltimore, but it was known as Murder Mall, and people knew exactly where you were talking about because it was so violent. Now, in a place like that that gets razed, thankfully, because humans shouldn't live in a place that you give a moniker like that, right?
Right.
Is there any preferential treatment opportunities to pass through legally by fast tracking a project like that, where, you know, we can make sure we go through the proper steps, because a lot of what needs to be done at a public hearing is to make sure the public approves of some of these plans. But whatever the red tape paperwork is for developers, are there any pass through opportunities for projects, or are they in line like everyone else?
Right. As far as I know, generally these projects are in line with everyone else. There can be some help when like the political forces align and there's an opportunity for, say, the mayor's office or planning staff or someone in the housing department to help out a project or check in on a permit and say what's going on. But other than that, there's no formalized process. And so I think that's one thing to think about for the mayor. I know they've announced a bunch of initiatives to deal with the vacant housing crisis. I haven't seen specifics, I know they're, aside from putting more money into the issue, but that'd be one of my critiques, would be to look at how they can streamline processes. People, the public and lay people don't see the full picture because it's kind of arcane and esoteric, but for example, just stormwater management approvals, where you have to design runoff from rain and pavement and where it goes on a site, that can take over a year and a half by itself. And that obviously it costs. And there are ways to streamline that if developers are willing to pay for outside review or expedited review, but that costs more money. So if a project like this, which I imagine must have a low-income affordable housing component and limits the amount of rent that can be charged and limits the value, means the developer has to be cost conscious. There are ways the city could marshal resources to be more helpful and maybe assign a point person to get it through. To the other point about like community review also, that can be an issue. And so that's one of those gray policy areas. I understand completely politicians, council members often want that political cover to know that the community supports the project and they're behind it 100% because they don't want criticism, and the voters are usually the people who live there. And so it makes sense that they would be responsive to them. On the other side, I think the city and officials should try to make the policy decision to say, hey, it's important, for example, that this project is developed for the former Murder Mall or generally vacant housing, and say, we're going to streamline the process. And then not everyone's going to be happy. People are going to be scared of change, but it's important to our city to say, we're going to develop vacant housing and make development happen here. And if that means some people are still object, you know, we apologize, but there's greater things at stake here. And I mean, that's the bigger critique of development projects, is that people often forget that there's the stakeholders in the community are one set of people impacted, but the future people who will live there who don't have a voice, but they will be impacted too. And so the lack of development means people can't move into the community, and that hurts them. So the longer things get drawn out, you know, that it hurts them, it hurts the region.
I tell you, you know, part of the problem is the trust and confidence, because developers contribute a lot to political parties and political candidates. And, you know, the community feels that they are influencing it, and they do it to influence their projects. And, you know, these are for profit at the end of the day. But at the same time, these are necessities in some communities. And I, you know, use a project like this because I remember all the pomp and circumstance around it. And it is something in a community that can use the transition. And you almost think this is something that you want to expedite. However, there is also a need to make sure the community is included. But at the same time, the things that we can do to expedite this, we need to do it. We need to make sure that's not the impediment of getting this project off the ground. And to your point, maybe we should be looking at trying to streamline those. And that might roll right into another project that has been stalled for many, many years, maybe I think longer than this one. And that's the Charles Center. The Mechanic Theater was torn down many years ago. And I know that there's a lawsuit because I believe there's a parking garage underground there, but that's a pile of rubble in the downtown business district right near the Baltimore Arena. I don't know what it's called right now, the Royal Farms Arena.
Yep.
And, you know, I look at some of these and wonder, and I don't want to sound naive, I think I know the answer, but why can't it just be grass, a grassy park until we can figure it out, as opposed to a fence that starts to fall down?
It's like my office actually looks over that site, or my office used to look over the Mechanic Theater, and I was working as a younger associate when it started being taken down, and there were plans to go forward with development. Right. So it wasn't like the developer was stalling or pretending or misrepresenting. There was legit plans that were in the paper, and they're going forward through the approval process. But there was that lawsuit with the parking garage, the down under garage, mm-hmm. over an easement. And that's an example too, where the risk in development that took, I think, 5 or 6 years to go through the court process and the circuit court and the appeal to the Court of Special Appeals. I think in Court of Appeals, and they might have settled things. But then in that probably 10-year timeline, if not longer, since the time the developer acquired the property and went through the process to get approval for the demolition and for the new site, things changed in the market. And downtown core especially has a lot of change and upheaval as activity and energy has sort of shifted from downtown, where my office is, to Harbor East and now to Harbor Point. There's going to be a lot of questions about what uses could go here to fill the site that's designed and allows for a lot of density by right, which is helpful and makes it easier for the approval process. But at the end of the day, I guess there's a lot here and probably nationwide about how downtown cores and cities will be designed.
Right. Wow. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do with this podcast here is just try to tie everything together, because the concerns that we have in the city, not unique from many other cities, but of course we're focused on Baltimore. We try to tie them all together, and we need to change some things. We need to be innovative. We can be leaders in certain things. And if that means streamlining some processes, we need to bring more residents to the city. And if we are the leaders in how we're going to reuse our downtown or what have you, then let's do it. But of course the vacant houses is a problem. The vacant dwellings, the vacant spaces is a problem. I was always impressed with architects in DC and how they would be able to get a building in the smallest of spaces there, and boom, there it is. We have these big lots. So I interviewed the Charm City Builders recently, and a young couple who are teaching others and rebuilding homes themselves. Daunting task, because we have plenty of them. Tell me some of your thoughts on how we could aggressively go about some of the rebuilding of these vacant homes.
Yeah, I listened to your podcast with them. They're a great couple. I've come across them on social media, but I'd like to talk to them too. They're doing great work. but they're a good example of the limitations of the market and how development and rehabs work. I think the big issue for the city that we're confronting with vacant homes is there's a lack of demand for housing in some communities. And I think they mentioned it too, and I've seen online, I've seen reports that the cost of doing a rehab, making it compliant with the building code and modern codes and doing removal of, say, lead, that things are toxic, can take the cost $200,000. And if the way the development process works is, if you're an investor looking to invest in a property, say, a vacant building, you would look at the cost and say, well, it's going to cost $200,000 if I spend my $200,000 in the market. If I buy a treasury bond or a bill, that would be a 3% rate and there's no risk. Do that, sit back and get my 3% interest.
Right.
So that's one way to think about it. And so you compare the cost and say, well, if I put $200,000 into a row home to fix it, what would my return be? And in some communities that these cannot command the level of rent to justify that. One of my bigger, I guess, critiques or issues is in some communities, the way to make the rental income go up would be to have more units in the building. So some row homes or larger homes on the west side of the city, Holland's Market Square area, beautiful homes. You can tell from like the old money Baltimore, but they're three stories, huge buildings, 6,000 square feet. There's no way, obviously, one family could live there, even in a nicer neighborhood,
right,
much less in a neighborhood that can't command that kind of rent. But the issue that developers who work with me have is that there's a process to get approved for that. Those areas are usually zoned, it's called R7 or R8, which allows like row home development. But the city zoning code has a provision that requires a developer to go to the city council to convert from single family to multifamily. And so there's reasons for that. It makes sense. Sometimes community members are fearful of overcrowding or too many families in a building. Some of that's based on legitimate concerns. Some of it's based on maybe classist issues and worries about between people in a tenement home. But that's the sort of thing that has to happen if you want to make a project pencil out in some of these neighborhoods. People can't afford to pay the rent necessary to pay for the cost of rehabbing a building. But if you had four units in a building or five or six, an old big row home, then they pay, say, $1,000 each. And then they can make the project work out. But other than that, that's what you see what happens in some areas where the buildings just stay vacant forever. I don't know if we can get into it later, but that's one of my thoughts about, for example, where the fire happened. There's just no market for vacant homes, unfortunately. And so, I mean, there's a lot of history that came out, but there's like not much the city could do under its current plans to stimulate something.
So that makes me wonder, like, a place that I've always often wondered about, and you probably don't know this off the top of your head, maybe you do, North Avenue near Coppin State, those big row homes, and it's plenty of empty ones there. Are they not zoned for multi-unit, multi-family?
Yep, some aren't. I actually worked on a project over there with, was it Doc Cheatham's neighborhood, I believe. So is that
Matthew Henson?
Yeah, Matthew A. Henson neighborhood. And luckily there, the developer I was working with is a young brother from like the area. And so he's able to get a rapport and get community support.
Mm-hmm.
And with that support, we can go to the zoning board, because that one actually was grandfathered in for multi-unit approval. But we had to get a few more to make the project pencil out. And there, because he had that bond with the community, it was a little easier. But it still cost him engaging me, an attorney, who's expensive. Worth it, but still that adds money and time to the process. And right. So he did it, but it took a long time. And now he got the approval from the zoning board. That took a few months. Now let's go through the permitting process, which will take time. And that's an example of somewhere where maybe if the city decided we're going to prioritize this thing, we're going to have to decide, or we're going to make it easy, just go straight through the process. Obviously the downside could be the community will have concerns, but that's again one of those issues you got to kind of decide how we're going to prioritize things in our city. One of my views also is that the issues should be more about code enforcement and issues with like the behavior. People don't, in my view, don't care as much as about the people in the building anymore. Like there's fewer, less overt racism and less classism, but they just care about the impact if they can't park in the area or if there's trash piling up or people are too loud. So we have to come up with a way to at least mitigate that or allow people in the community to have a relief valve to say, hey, this group, those people here are too loud. I want to see some changes. Let's make it happen.
Yeah. And maybe I'm, again, too naive or not smart enough about this particular issue, but it seems like we should have some zoning exemptions for multi-family dwellings along North Avenue, as a for instance, to redevelop them for the purpose of student housing with a university there, because they're huge, but there are a lot of vacant homes. But if a developer wants to develop those one floor each for three students that want to live there, seems like that would be well worth their time. And again, we, in my opinion, this is me being opinionated here, making some areas priority zones. We're going to put a red, I don't even want to use the word red line. We're going to put a yellow line around areas that we're going to prioritize, that they're going to get preference, because we need to fast track this, because we can't lose out. Because if we lose out, it's going to take us years to get investors back in here, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the low-hanging fruit areas for the city's development policy could be to really think through how to leverage our institutions. It's sort of happening naturally in Johns Hopkins. And actually, like the area around Johns Hopkins, Charles Village area, I'm working on a project up there. Like, people have noted, it's one of the few areas in the city, even during the pandemic, that's had a lot of vitality and people walking around. That's mostly because the students there, but that's a sign. Like downtown's been sort of slow and really dead. And other neighborhoods, even like the Federal Hill Canton area, which normally drive in, have been sort of slow. But Charles Village has had this vitality, and that's because people are there, different incomes, some students, some grad students, people who are longtime residents and renters, who are also residents. They contribute to the community. And so I think there's a way to, we should be building up around Coppin and Morgan and keeping people in the city. And I have more thoughts about that, but I think one like low hanging fruit would be allowing student housing. I thought before I did this sort of work, I would have not realized how much opposition there is to students. I guess it makes sense. Students can be loud and rowdy, but even like housing, I've noticed communities are weary of, and maybe that goes back to the lack of code enforcement issues. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's a really way to do it. You keep the students in the area, make them happy, have a little walkable community where they can walk to school, come back home, and also spark more of a nightlife cultural scene, especially around Morgan and Coppin, have a Black nightlife and cultural scene, which seems to be lacking. When I came to Baltimore, I grew up here, but then went to law school and undergrad and came back, like I chose an area on the waterfront to be near the bars and I wanted to go out and have a good time. And I think that because I'm comfortable with that, I went to predominantly white institutions, it's a Black man. So I'm comfortable with those scenes, right. But not everyone is. And right. So if we had more scenes where people are comfortable in their own skin, that can make people stay, and they might be likely to stay and plant roots to stay a few years. Cause right now, even still, it's been like 20 years, the cultural cachet has been, I'm gonna go to Atlanta, Philly, have a good time, or DC,
right?
But not Baltimore. And it's a shame because Baltimore has such a history of Black culture and then Black income and wealth in the region. Unfortunately, less in the city, but the whole region has tons of people of color who have money to spend and want to have a good time. And so we can really cater to them.
Build around a lot of
vitality. Right.
They have to build around those specific needs. And unfortunately, seems to be lacking. And said that housing could be a start. And, you know, I do think I got an opportunity to speak with former Mayor Kurt Schmoke as well. And he actually mentioned, when I asked that question, untapped opportunities here or something that we should really be talking about more. And he talked about the colleges, that building around them and really talking about them more. Was something.
It's such a treasure and a valued resource. And even myself, I grew up in the west side of Baltimore County and decent school, public schools, but like I didn't even, or maybe it's my guidance counselor's fault, didn't push me to Johns Hopkins or any of the schools in the city, despite their quality. And I kind of wish they had, because kind of people forget how good the institutions are in our city. And we could really leverage that. And we get people here coming from around the world. Mm-hmm. And we could do more to think about how to keep them here and plant roots and kind of be part of the city's fabric.
Absolutely. And it would be and expand from there. So, you know, and again, this is going to be more opinion based from you. But I look at the former officer and teacher next door programs that existed in, say, late 90s, early 2000s. And we have a lot of money from the American Rescue Plan coming into the city. And I was wondering if a designated amount of that money could be put forth for maybe a program like that. I call it more of a municipal employees program, where we don't specifically target a profession, but we target those who work for the government, basically, to try to grow Baltimore's population through the employers first, DPW, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that? And then again, going back to that yellow line, not designating areas that they had to live in, like the former next door programs, but a rehab, city owned rehab housing. We'll give you forgivable loans and the city use some of this money. Is that something that sounds logical, doable, legal?
It does. I assume it's legal. I know there's already plans and like programs for tax credits for municipal employees, and there's one especially for first responders and officers, which is a way to get around the political thorniness of density sometimes, where communities can be weary of a big multifamily housing project. I know, for example, there's one in Remington, the Seawall project. One of their first ones was for teachers, and that I wasn't involved in the project, but that would seem to be one of those ones that would be, okay, well, we can't really hate on teachers. You see a lot with like senior citizens, senior homes too, where like people, would oppose a big building, but okay, it's for seniors. It's for my grandparents, or my parents can live one day. Okay, well, I'm going to not come out with pitchforks for that. And so similarly, a way to kind of allow that density to happen would be, make sense to me, in a way to spark a market. I think the overarching issue or problem the city faces is that we're losing the middle class, and there was no draw for them to stay. Some of it's maybe related to schools, but like, and we've, I think, with a broad brush, painted it as white flight, but we're seeing more now. It's black middle class flight.
Absolutely.
And this is sort of like the William Julius Wilson critique, is like the concentrated poverty happened with the end of the segregation. So when middle class black families could finally go to the suburbs in the 70s and 80s, after too long of being locked out, they left the inner city areas. But when they left the connections they had as middle class people with jobs. And so the people left behind had increasing poverty. It was more concentrated lack of connections to jobs and resources, and the lack of like a role model to say, hey, that guy goes to the job, goes to the office every day, or goes downtown, has a government job, he's a good guy. They don't see that. And then there's lack of connection to more jobs. And then the issue we have is that as people, we spend money in these areas, maybe not enough, but we spend people on people who can get the self, I guess the services and grow themselves, get jobs, decide not to stay. They decide to move to the county. And we're the city is paying for people to leave the area.
Right.
But we can come up with ways to keep people here. One of my views is like cultural amenities would be a way to do that, but also with tax credits and incentives to say, hey, if you stay, if you're a sanitation worker in DPW, a water worker, please stay and be part of the community. We want you to keep your dollars here.
Yeah. And just to reset for people who aren't familiar with the Officer Next Door and Teacher Next Door program, there was a commitment to live in a particular area that was a revitalization type area, but you were able to get that house for half off, basically. So if it was a $300,000 house, you got it for $150,000. You had to live in it. I think it might have been 3 years back then. And then it was yours outright to sell or what have you. And you got all the equity in it. And it was a heck of an incentive, especially when the market turned and people were able to make a lot of money on it. But I think a similar thing could be put in place today to allow people to earn and, some loan forgiveness, so to speak, similar to how we need to do some student loans and streamline that process. But to get people to be here, and you have a buy-in where it's you're going to have to be here before you outright own it and are able to get that equity out. So hopefully right. We can be creative and think about that.
It's about changing the value proposition. So there's different levers that you can pull. Some of it are financial. Some of it, it's like the cultural ones, what I think might be lower hanging fruit because it's not as expensive. And some things in city government can be like turning a cruise liner around, but low hanging fruit could be, hey, we're going to help jumpstart the area. So we'll have built-in middle-class working class people here with some money to spend. So maybe that will incentivize restaurants and bars to cater to them and other stores. And that's how basic urban planning 101, you grow a community that way. So with more people there, spending money there, then you can have more people catering to them and go to market.
And to that end, you look at the city right now is unfortunately built to send you to the county to shop. There aren't any department stores really here. I think you have one Target and a Nordstrom Rack in the city. No Walmarts, some people shop there, some don't. But the bottom line is you just don't have many places to go if you want to do that type of shopping. And in order to lure those type of businesses to a city, which many places around the country have, you have to create those environments of people who are going to spend the money and bring it in town. So, You talk about Baltimore City Housing Department and the need to streamline some processes there because there are people who want to invest there, right? And there's a lot of red tape involved. What do you think can be done there where they can just, we've already slowed down. We don't need to slow down anymore. Let's speed up some.
Yeah, I can go all day. And I don't want to be too critical on the people in house in the department because, they're good people. Some are working really hard and they're constrained. Yeah. But then there's also the part where they're in their job day to day. They can't step back and look at the bigger picture and rethink, maybe we could be more efficient in some areas. I was talking to somebody the other day who asked, what if we did more electronic DocuSign things or something like that? And that's all part of it. There's lots of ways, lots of low-hanging fruit things to sign. One of the I'll give an example. It's less about the housing permitting process, but the city's deed recordation process has been really hurt by COVID. So in their defense, remote work has been challenging. And usually what happens is if you buy a home, you buy your own home, your title company or your escrow agent, realtor would take the deed, send it to, or with a messenger, go to the Ava Woman building downtown. You sit in an office with someone in the Department of Finance, goes over it, makes sure the transfer taxes are calculated correctly. It takes, in my opinion, longer than it should, but an hour and a half, they stamp it. Then you, as a messenger, would take it over from that building to the courthouse, pay more fees, they process it, and it's recorded. But that can be done in a day. Now, with remote work, it takes months. Mm-hmm. And that's been an issue. And I've talked to maybe your colleague, Mallory, on the news about this, because there's been, she's covered this as well, there's been such a long delay that it really hurts the smaller rehabs. So if you're a house flipper,
I'm gonna get in trouble for saying this. The progressive wing is gonna come after me for saying this. Why don't we go right on to Fayette and President and grab four squeegee boys to do that? Here, take these papers and walk them across the street for us every single day so we can eliminate months of work and pay them $20 an hour to do it and get stuff done.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of jobs, and I have lots of opinions about that, especially the low skill or jobs don't require the sort of computational ability. I mean, in the Department of Finance's defense, there's you have to review deeds, and there can be some complications with taxes, but it shouldn't take months, but things are delayed. But other jurisdictions, I think everyone in the state except for us is now basically all electronic. You can do it virtually.
I bet.
Still, Baltimore, you have to go in person and things get lost. And with checks, and so there's been a couple of issues that checks will take so long to get processed that they can go on a date, so they expire. And the city will send it back or call you if you're lucky and give them a new check in, or they'll lose it. But the issue is, so if you're a flipper, you buy a house that's vacant from somebody, like a wholesaler or a realtor, and normally there's a deed going from that wholesaler or realtor to you, flipper. You do the work for a month or two, then you find a buyer who's willing to buy. A friend he did the work to fix it, had a buyer ready to go in a transition neighborhood by Joy Hill Park, and the deed to him, the flipper, didn't get recorded yet, so he can't give it to the next person to buy. And that poor lady who's ready to buy, had a rate at a good level, ready to buy and move in, couldn't move in because her lender wouldn't let the deal go through until the deed was recorded. And it's been months now, and she had, I assume, had to walk away. And then now rates are going up, and so who knows if she can qualify. She's on the edge to qualify for her mortgage. That right there.
And example. And that goes back to the very start of this, the larger projects that get stalled and you walk away from them, you end up with a big hole in the ground versus one individual property, which can end up being 15,000. But, you know, and just to clarify, the men and women who work at these agencies, many are wonderful people who try to go above and beyond to make things work. They are just hindered and hampered by the outdated systems that exist and outdated processes, because we've had so much turnover at higher administrations in a lot of ways. And we just have to update our thinking. You know, it's crazy. I just did a refi, and I did a refi completely online, basically. I had a person come out to me, meet me. They dispatched this person to meet me where I was to me in 10 or 15 minutes. And I had to sign a few documents in person, but everything else was DocuSign. And I was able to close on my refi within about 15 days from putting in my application to them. And, you know, to do all of that, that quickly, getting documents all virtual, we're in 2022. And we have to think how quickly, especially with the challenges that we have in our city, because we're trying to turn it quickly. We need to lock you in. We need to get you while we got you. You're looking, you want it, we're going to get you in, you know? Yeah.
My view is like the money ball principle. We're at a disadvantage, structurally, in Baltimore. There's lots of issues. And I think some activists are always unfair with blaming Baltimore first without recognizing the constraints we have as a city that you can't expand. We can't annex more property like other cities can. Funding for urban projects dried up since the 70s and 80s, and things have been pushed towards a market-driven approach. So the city only has so many levers it can pull to make development happen. But one low-hanging fruit is the money ball. Like, make sure the processes are good. One of my jobs in the city hall when I was there was in the city stat office. And that was where we were young, junior people. But we went to the agencies and sort of looked at the processes and things and looked at the data. This is one of the O'Malley era thing, like filling a pothole in two days and we're going to get it done. So it went to things and figure out how can we streamline the process? What's going on here? Why are there issues? And trying to cut through it all, because that's the issue. And usually these rules and structures aren't handed down on stone tablets. These are things we can be made and we can change them, but it just takes a little bit of time and processing and think through, can we change or not? And then let's do it.
Yeah. Well, that's a best practice. You should certainly look at how you can be more efficient, and especially when we're trying our best to address an issue. So now you talked about the zoning process, and I want to bring up something that might be a bit controversial, and it's something that's talked about in the legislative process often, and that's the liquor store thing. I can't get over this whole liquor store thing. Apparently, it's unique in the Baltimore metro area, where you can't even get this liquor alcohol on Sunday. And places on the west side of the county, especially the west side of the city and county. But Not being able to buy it in grocery stores is interesting in the state, and it's something that is often brought up, and it's up again this year. Small liquor stores, mom and pop type liquor stores, are against it because they think it'll kill their businesses. But the Retailers Association actually is for it. What are your thoughts on that? And again, I'm asking you for your opinion. I know that you're not an expert in that particular area, but do you think it could lure more supermarkets to Baltimore, understanding that we do have a bit of a deficit where there are some food deserts that exist throughout the city?
Sure. And I can maybe hopefully give some background too. So the city's zoning code was reformed in, it was a 10-year process that finished in 2017. It's called Transform Baltimore. Some listeners may have heard of it. They basically revamped the entire zoning code for the first time since 1971. One of the big components and pushes in that code rewrite was to phase out what they're calling non-conforming liquor stores. So liquor stores in residentially zoned areas had 2 years to close. They cited research from, I believe, Hopkins School of Health, where they argued that the density of liquor licenses in an area contributed to crime. So that's a fair argument. My personal critique is it's not clear to me that they drive crime versus they're just there. In some communities, if that's the only thing there, people might gather there and then they're a target for crime. I guess the other view might be that they maybe gather there to engage in illicit activities and drug dealing. But either way, it's like, I guess my counter argument would be, well, if they are engaging in drug dealing, you just observe that, then arrest them. But with the zoning code change, they're phasing out liquor stores. Some are staying and some have gotten zoning relief, but I think they're still challenging that in the courts. But there's this, obviously this view, and I understand, especially people from the older generation, and especially in the Black community, are weary of drinking and I guess even like drug or marijuana legalization, but they're weary of that. So I understand there's that concern there. I mean, my personal view is, there's no reason alcohol by itself could lead to crime. If you have TGI Fridays, you wouldn't expect it to be an issue. It's people do all the time and drink safely. It's just a moderation. So there's a push and pull there. To back up for the listeners too, there's a provision in the state law that was implemented, I think in the 70s, maybe 80s, that limited or prohibited new grocery stores from getting liquor licenses. So some are grandfathered in now, and some like stores on the Eastern Shore might be, but new ones aren't permitted. And so in areas with food deserts, that's one of my thoughts is like, why not incentivize and make the market there to allow grocery stores to make it profitable to go to community. And if alcohol has higher margins, that might make it possible for grocery stores to decide to move to an area. Mm-hmm. I think there was a report from the ShopRite when they had a lease to go on the Howard Park of mm-hmm. that area. They reported they needed like a reduction in their loan or waive the loan from the city. Their point or argument was they need that because they can't make the financing or the dollars work. And the city reviewed and agreed. But the show is it's tough to run a grocery store in these communities with margins where they're lower. And so if you can do something like sell alcohol, then make it work where, even if corporations have a history of racial discrimination or bad practices, ultimately they're incentivized by money. And if they can make money in an area, they would be more inclined to go there. And it'd be a win-win to build the tax base, build out shopping centers in the sort of communities that have been underinvested in, and improve the area. One more downside, to be fair to the incumbent liquor stores, is that it's tough because some of them pay lots of money, or the liquor licenses have some value because they had to pay themselves to get the liquor license. So if that's something you've used to collateralize your loan or sort of like your retirement plan is to sell your license or sell your store one day, and then out of the blue, grocery store comes in, just either gets a new license by right because they got some state law change, or they bought them from somebody else, but that would hurt people. So I think we have to be cognizant of like the impacts to
right.
some of those stores.
Definitely a delicate balance for sure. It just seems like we need to be creative again, using that word, as to how we can lure more opportunities of need into the community. And alcohol certainly is not one that I call a need, but it's leveraging something that already exists with something that is needed. And as you just pointed out, you have to sweeten the deal somehow, because the profit margins, at the end of the day, this is a business. And I think some people do forget that these corporations aren't running charities, and they are, that's just the reality. And I don't know that a lot of people, or not a lot of people, some people don't understand that. So,
and the benefit, I mean, I guess, setting aside the public health issue, but like, I mean, consumers across the city and the state would benefit by lower prices. And so mm-hmm. I guess the question would be, do we, you know, should we force the entire state to pay a few dollars more, if not more, to buy alcohol when other states, DC, they sell at Costco for cheaper?
Right.
Like, should we be subsidizing that? And is there a benefit to our health and safety from allowing mom and pop stores to have the monopoly on the ability to sell? I mean, that's a policy decision, but you know, I come out and they decide where it's like, I personally prefer cheaper alcohol.
Yeah. And maybe there's some ways that the mom and pop stores could be incentivized differently for the concession of allowing the grocery stores to sell. And how that looks, I'm not a legislator, so I'll let them work it out. But I think we need to at least selfishly think about Baltimore and the food deserts, at least, to try to address it. But
yeah, one of my ideas also has been like to use ARPA money, and maybe there's restrictions, but like maybe spark the market, figure out how we can make the grocery stores pencil out. If that's give land for free, work our own co-op, give the market, like the Northeast market or some other markets, and do what we need to do to prop something up. If the costs don't work out, do we need to, what is necessary to make the project pencil out? Do we need to cut taxes? I know it's like a fear of having a giveaway or a corporate handout, but if the market were there, they would be going there already, and they're not. So we got to figure out what levers we can pull to incentivize or push people to go.
The old "it takes money to make money" adage. I agree with that. So, as we come towards the conclusion of this, we have to talk about housing again, still, and of course, a bit of a disparity, and not a bit, a definite disparity. And one thing that Kurt Schmoke and I were talking about, he talked about the poverty in Baltimore and how so much of it existed in Baltimore during his tenure as mayor. And he expressed that, and it, you know, it was just half was in Baltimore City, in the whole state, half was in Baltimore City. Yeah. How has that played a role here versus the suburbs, as you've seen it, and when it comes to that housing and development and the disparity that we're seeing?
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier. I think like zoning is my the matrix. It kind of rules everything. It kind of dictates everything around me. Like once I saw it and realized it and got more senior in my current role and read up on like the history of Baltimore and sociology projects, I realized that's really in my view, like explains our city in that
right.
For decades, Baltimore County had exclusionary zoning policies, wouldn't allow either. De jure wouldn't allow people of color in the area, and they pushed out black ethnic enclaves. My family hails from Cowdensville in the Arbutus area, but one of the few black neighborhoods that date back to post-slavery that was able to stay. But in many areas of the county, they did expulsive zoning to push those black areas out, or like allow industrial use to go in there, and made it impossible to keep the homes there. So what happened was in the cities in those poor areas, there's a concentration of poverty. And then as the county opened up its zoning in some areas like the West Side, you see more development and more people of color there is because they allowed some denser housing apartments to go there, but not in Timonium or Hunt Valley or Moncton.
Right.
And so you see people going to that side, but then that leads to concentration of issues on the West Side of the county as well. But so what happened was people in the city who left, middle-income people who could afford to go, took advantage of that. It makes sense that they had children. They wanted to get the schools and avoid the issues with the crack epidemic. And so who were left behind were people who were poor and unable to go. And so then now, because the county home prices are crazy, that people are still stuck here and who can't afford to go anywhere, and they're stuck in place. So one of my big, I guess, critiques are, if I had a power in charge, I would promote the voucher program or make housing vouchers entitlement. I mean, that one of the big issues is that, unlike, say, Social Security, where it's like you're guaranteed it by right, the housing vouchers from HUD are limited. And so I think they cut the waitlist off for the city.
Right.
And so people just can't leave. There's no housing voucher. If they can leave, we'd be diffusing poverty. I know someone, family friend, his older sister, got one of the moving to opportunity vouchers when I think the Lexington Terrace was torn down. But she's used that successfully. She went from the terrace to Howard County. Her kids are in great schools. Her kids all went to college. One's a teacher. And so, like, if you can diffuse the poverty and get them into different opportunities, that's how you allow for the growth. And that's something we should think about. And allowing, even in the city. So some of the issues are some vouchers can't go across the city county line, but there are places in the city that are nice, and that could be available if we allowed more density, allowed some multifamily in, say, Roland Park, or allowed more like English basements, ADUs, fourplexes, maybe be more affordable for families to live in these nicer neighborhoods and get away from the concentrated poverty.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what it's going to take for us to just think more creatively. I've used that word a number of times here, but hopefully we can figure that out and, you know, start doing it. And I want to wrap up with a transit-oriented development question. Reisterstown Road Plaza's metro parking lot now is going to be redeveloped. And for people who know that area, one of the lots, I believe it used to be a lot, is now the Social Security Administration. And now the other lot is about to be redeveloped. And I'm someone, I went to middle school in that area. So I used to catch the metro every day, and you never would see those parking lots full of cars for years. Are these underutilized areas and that are finally getting redeveloped into something? We see Owings Mills Metro Station being blown up into a big development. Both sides are going to be huge. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the transit-oriented development? Reisterstown Plaza, Rogers Station, and Cold Spring are the city opportunities above.
This is another one where if I, you know, we take your yellow circle, we should be drawing them around the transit, like one of these hubs. Like there's a critique that the subway or light rail doesn't go anywhere, but I mean, that's not true. There are people, and usually they're minorities who are there, but we could be doing more to build up around them with density and housing. A lot of those areas outside the Reisterstown Road Plaza parking lot, or the Reisterstown, I guess, subway station parking lot, they are single family detached homes spread out. Normally it's kind of basic urban planning. You want to have more density right there. So like conversely, if you go to Arlington now, Arlington has tons of basically skyscrapers along the metro line or Wamata line. And that, you know, makes sense for policy. It's cheaper, then people don't need a car, they can get around. And then there's still room for housing that could be detached in Arlington. They kind of, you go a few blocks away, it kind of converts to single family detached housing. But here we have right next to the station, I think it was the Reisterstown one or the Rogers Avenue one I was looking at recently, like it's basically like a cemetery and a bunch of R6 zoned properties. R6 is,
and it's Rogers has a cemetery right across the street,
right? And so like so that cemetery obviously you can't build on, but around, other than that, there's also a bunch of spread out homes, large yards, large setbacks, and there's a lot of area requirements mean you can't build much density. And so even if a developer acquired 5 lots around, he couldn't or she couldn't build up large enough to make sense, in my view, to allow for that development to happen. I mean, of course, the downside is there are existing homeowners and people are weary of change and displacement. But it's another one of those policy areas where we decide what's important. The city says and the state says we're focused on climate change and climate resiliency. And this is one of those things that if we're going to have a big subway station here, we got to build up around it, unfortunately. And by the way, I guess if you're a homeowner there, which most of these places are owner occupied, you'll get a lot of value from your property value going up. Mm-hmm. You don't have to sell, you could stay. And you might have more neighbors and your value will go up more. And it kind of goes back to even like the issue with crime too. If you have more people walking around, there's more eyes in the street and things can be safer.
Right.
I guess it also is an issue at the Penn Station renovation too. There's money going to that finally, but then the zoning around it is still sort of, in my view, under what should be there for like a major train station in Baltimore. And we could be using that area to leverage the DC proximity and say to the DC workers who are priced out, hey, come live in Baltimore. Go, if you're going down once a week, live nearby, walk to the train station and take the MART train down to DC.
Oh, and yes, you've tweeted about that. And that's I'm a big Penn Station fan. I actually just a couple weeks ago, as we get some warm days here, my son and I jumped on a train and went down to DC. And I can't wait for the renovation to, it already has started and, you know, go into full gear. And I still don't know why the Metro didn't go through Penn Station when it was built.
I've heard rumors about Schaefer having a hand in drawing the line, but that's one of those things too. I guess deal with community stakeholders that can change the location of a subway or light rail line.
I don't know why that should have certainly happened. The big hub of a transit there, but anyway, that's very interesting, man. It's a lot to this, no doubt about it. Get the legalese that there are some legal lines that have to be drawn. There's some public input that has to be solicited for these things. However, there's some streamlining that can be done, especially when we're talking about a city that is pretty much begging people to come, you know, and we're trying to reinvent ourselves. And we should start with an introspective look at what can we do better in order to make that happen. And there's some processes. Let's be a 21st century city and do some things easier, do some things better to make it easier for people. So thank you very much, Mr. Justin Williams, who is a great follow on Twitter at Charm City Zoning. So I would encourage you all to follow him and learn more about this zoning process, because you break it down in digestible bites so you can really see this project and then you say exactly why it should be this, like the Penn Station area, for instance, because that area is going to be an area on redevelopment. If you go look at the plans of what's going to be happening over there in the Mount Vernon area with Penn Station. So thank you very much, Justin, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about zoning, and my wife gets tired of me talking about it. So I'm happy to find an audience either with you or on Twitter to people who are interested in this stuff. I think it's like such an undervalued, underappreciated kind of aspect of city life and why our city is the way it is.
Yes, and it's how things get done. And thanks to all of you for listening. We aim to be more, and until next time, I'll talk to you soon.